Your Grace, ladies and gentlemen, it's wonderful to have you all here. It's wonderful to see a packed room, a room I have to say we were decanted into from a much smaller room because of the size of the response. It's a bit like being taken out of a dinghy and put into the Queen Mary. I have to say, this room took my breath away. It's one of the biggest rooms that I've ever done anything in. But anyway, wonderful to see you. Thank you for coming. My name is Jenny Taylor. I'm the Executive Director of Lapido Media. There's a load of information about it on your chairs. Please read Mark Lern. Before I do my thanks and my introductory remarks, I'd like to read a story, which is what Lapido does. We do stories. This is a story about Egypt. We learned that extremists were going to attack us with machine guns, but we did not prepare ourselves for the attack with weapons. We did something simple, says Bishop Thomas. About that day, he received a message that armed hardliners were on their way to his episcopal residence in the Al-Qusayr region of Lower Egypt. Determined to defend themselves without violent means, the church fathers applied soap and water on the rocky path leading to Bishop Thomas's residence. This is a story from September the 11th this year. I saw them coming with their machine guns far down the road. They tried to get to the house, but they slipped and fell. They tried over and over again without succeeding, says the bishop. Those attacks have paradoxically brought Muslims and Christians of his area closer together. He says, poor Muslim families brought blankets to the Christians who lost their homes, and together we formed a civil front. Not Christians against Muslims, but civil society against extremism. Images and video clips from Muslims and Christians who hand in hand formed a protective ring circle around churches were shared on social media across the globe. Unfortunately, that story did not make it onto CNN, did not make it into the press. And that's why we are here tonight, because we're here to help tell the story. It is something that Lapido feels is very important, to speak up about these stories that cut to the chase and get to the truth better than theory. We have a lot to be thankful to journalists for. I am one myself. And I believe that the more we understand the logistical issues of getting to the story, the better the discourse will become. And I'm absolutely thrilled that we've got such a strong lineup tonight of people who do believe in cutting to the chase, who do believe in listening to the people, telling a truer story. And the point is, people, particularly in the majority world, are very religious. When you cut to the chase, you actually get to what motivates people. So we believe that religion cannot be airbrushed out of the story in the way that Westerners tended to have been trained to do, that somehow there is a neutral vantage point that can actually ignore religious motivation. If that happens, you miss the truth. And we've got to goad one another to remember, and that's really what Lapido does. We are a goad, because it is too important not to understand religion. I was hoping the Sunday Times foreign editor would join us on the panel, and he said, oh, but I don't know anything about minorities. And I thought, would a sports editor say, oh, but I know nothing about yachting or judo, minority sports, and be taken with any degree of seriousness? Clearly not. So, without further ado, I'd really like to thank Henry Jackson Society for allowing us to piggyback on their broader shoulders. We're much smaller than they are, but they have given us a chance to raise the profile of this crucial issue, and to do so in a splendid venue like this. I have to say, they have been an absolute delight to work with. Courtesy itself, all I have had to do is choose the speakers and sign the checks. I would also like to say that we have very much hoped that the BBC Arabic editor, Mohammed Yehia, would have joined us tonight, but he was unable to do so for family reasons. So do enjoy the debate. Do find out more about Lapido, Centre for Religious Literacy and World Affairs. Do join the debate if you're a twit. Hashtag Egypt will get you into the discussion that is ongoing now. Thank you again so much for coming.
Well, thank you very much, Jenny. My name is Douglas Murray from the aforementioned Check Receivers of the Henry Jackson Society. No, it's my great pleasure to welcome you tonight and to thank Jenny and Lapido Media for their co-sponsorship of this event. This I can't think of a better time or more important subject to address than that which we've got tonight, and I also can't imagine a better panel of experts than we have for you here tonight. So I'm going to not speak at all, other than to quickly ask if I could remind you, as one always has to, if you have mobile phones, please to turn them onto buzz or silent. Apart from anything else, I think the rules of the club mean you'll be expelled if you don't. But please manage that. And without further ado, I'd like to get on to the panel. I've asked them to all speak for roughly 10 minutes each at the outset, and then we will open that up to discussion, Q&A, I hope as much interaction with you, the audience, as possible. We've got an hour and a half, and I'd like to get going straight away. The first speaker, you've got all the bios, so I shan't read them all out to you, but our first speaker tonight is His Grace Bishop Angelos, and I'd like to invite him to open the proceedings tonight. Your Grace.
Thank you, and thank you for organising this wonderful event and for all of you who have come. Because as you could imagine, it's very close to my heart that the story is actually told properly. I think we are at a level now where we should look at lives as lives and not only statistics. And many examples have been seen over the past months and years that have spoken of death tolls and destruction and persecution as mere statistics. And I think it really doesn't tell the story. Egypt, whether you want to believe it or not, from someone who is Egyptian and also British, who goes to Egypt at least 3 or 4 times a year, and who is in constant contact with Egypt through the hierarchy of the church and through the grassroots of both Christians and Muslims living there, is in a much better place than it was. We are more hopeful now, I am more hopeful now, than in 2011 when the first uprising happened. And it happened at a very superficial level because it didn't have the infrastructure or the support to carry it through. It was quite headless in terms of revolution or uprising, and because of the political vacuum that was left, we then had an appearance of a religious group that decided to take this movement into its own direction. What concerns me is not that that happened, because that was expected. What concerns me is the way that this was highlighted and covered. There was so much focus once that stage came to an end and then President Morsi was removed on whether this was a coup or not a coup. And so much energy was expended on this that the real issues were not being looked at. What the people wanted became irrelevant, and what became important was how we here in the West perceive the occurrence to be. Did it tick the right boxes? Was it hypothetically and academically a coup? Was it democratic? Did people have a right to want this? Ladies and gentlemen, people have a right to do what they want, as long as it is determining their own country and the state and the future of that country. We can't sit here in the comfort of our own lounge rooms, in our armchairs, and pass judgment on what people do or don't want. Whether you think there were 5 million people in the streets or 30 million people in the streets, there were a lot of people in the streets. And they were Christian, and they were Muslim, and they were secular, and they were religious. They were men and women, young and old. They came from every part of Egyptian society, and they all wanted one thing. They all wanted a new start. What people will not tell you is, in that first year of the presidency of Mr. Morsi, who was until then quite clearly aligned and affiliated with a political party that was religiously driven, we found that unemployment rose to 30%. The stock market was at a 5-year low. Law and order was in a shambles, and crime had risen tenfold. There were fuel shortages, there were power cuts, there was an increased cost of living where people couldn't pay. But that wasn't covered in the media. What people were worried about was it a coup? For people who were starving, who had lost their jobs, who felt more and more marginalized and alienated, and I'm not just talking about Christians, I'm talking about Muslims, who did not fit within a very narrow perspective of what this process had become. It didn't matter what they were passing through. And everything was passed off as being sectarian violence. If extremist groups attacked and killed Shiite Muslims in the street, mercilessly slaughtering them, it was sectarian violence. If Christians were killed and churches were burned, and Al-Qaeda flags were flown over churches, it was sectarian violence. When Christians were killed in that space of time, more than the previous 20 years, just for being Christians, churches were demolished with bulldozers and were torched, burnt to the ground. It was sectarian violence. That is not sectarian violence. Sectarian violence is what we saw in Northern Ireland, when there were two groups at odds with each other and in conflict with each other. There was no sectarian violence. If anything, what happened over the past months brought Egypt together, not separated it. It brought people together. It blurred the Christian-Muslim divide. It blurred the religious-secular divide. It created a very clear distinction between religious extremists, Islamists, and the rest of the community. And the rest of the community became one, seeking a new start. We saw media coverage using terms like civil war. Now, anyone who knows Egypt knows there is never going to be a civil war in Egypt. We don't have a tribal background. We are a rural people that hold on to communities, Christians and Muslims together. We've been doing interfaith and interreligious and social cohesion for 1400 years. And I think it was being done okay, except, of course, when you look at the past decades, when we are told, and I have no reason to disbelieve this, that regimes were using the division to divide and conquer rather than to bring people together. The real crime over the past decades, and in particular over the past year, was not that there were Christians and Muslims living in the same country, but was that there was no pragmatic, intentional move towards bringing Christians and Muslim communities together. And there was an intentional move towards separating them. And we took what was already a very divided community and made it an extremely polarized one. And that was the crime. But that's not reported. What is reported is rhetoric, like the presence of makeshift field hospitals in Cairo. This is one of the leafiest, most expensive, affluent suburbs in Cairo. This wasn't a war zone. Yet what media wanted to do was to minimize issues and wanted us to think of Iraq, think of Libya, think of Syria, and then superimpose that onto Egypt. It's a very different place, very different dynamic. There was a completely blind eye turned to incitement of violence against Christians, against secularists. At the protests in Egypt that were quashed, that were dispersed, on that stage, people were called to eliminate Christians and Christianity from Egypt, to stand against secularists, because they were the ones who defiled Egypt, because they were ungodly. Appearing myself on various news media programs, I was pushed. Was the church pro-army or against? The church is pro-process. And if the army is part of that process, so be it. And I made a point several times. We were damned if you do and damned if you don't. In 2011, we were resistant. We didn't want to back a movement that we thought we saw was going to be destructive. We saw the end game. We knew it was going to happen. Yet we were called pro-Mubarak because we didn't back the revolution. Yet, in 2013, when a step was taken to move the community in the right direction, and we said, this looks plausible, we were called pro-regime and pro-military. People need to be seen for their wisdom, what they stand for, and what they understand. It's important for us not to just focus on broad headlines. There is much to be said. I can't say it all in 10 minutes, but all I want to conclude with is this, that people have a knowledge of their own country, and we must give them the understanding and the credit for knowing their own country and knowing the dynamics. Let us not export. Let us not, as media, try to dictate public opinion, but to report on reality and facts, and to report on them with evenness and with fairness, so that what is said in a newsroom here does not cause more pain to viewers and does not put members of societies at greater risk and in greater danger. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Grace. I'd like to turn now to a lady who is a foreign correspondent, fluent Arabic speaker, somebody who knows the region as a reporter as well, better than anyone, both in Egypt and the wider region. She's currently at the Pittsburgh Tribune, and I would like to now turn the floor over to Betsy Hahn.
Thank you. Standing in the smoldering ruins of the 16th century Emir Tadros Monastery, custodian Milad describes how a mob of Islamists attacked, looting and burning everything they could find. He talked about how there were more than 1,000 people, and when they attacked, they yelled out, Allahu Akbar, or God is great. This was a very small village called Al-Nuzla, and it was about 100 kilometers from Cairo. In that small village, two churches, one from 1932, another one recently finished in April, both were torched, as well as the monastery, and everything inside was looted. This happened on the same day, on August 14th, that the military and the police dispersed the two Islamist sit-ins in Cairo. Several weeks before all this happened, Islamists marked the homes of Christians, vowing to defend ousted President Mohamed Morsi with blood. In other places in Egypt, they also put X's on their doors, certain colors for the Christians and those for the Muslims. The hostility to Christians in this village was palpable. They would only use their first names because they were afraid of any sort of retaliation. A man, while we were standing trying to get in, waiting to get into the totally looted and burned monastery, a man on the back of a motorcycle points at the monastery and lets out a big laugh. And you could just feel that people had no sense of, no sense of, it was very disturbing. But discrimination and attacks on the Christian minority, who make up between, 10 to 15%, you would probably... Okay. has long been a problem in Egypt, and despite the Christians, they did join in 2011 January Revolution. I know quite a few who did. Attacks on Christians turned more frequent and more violent after and deadly as the Muslim Brotherhood and their Islamist allies took over the government and the presidency. Christians had faced many attacks since the January 2011 revolution. I've covered a violent Salafi cuts off the ear of a Christian he doesn't like in Upper Egypt, in Kenna. Churches were attacked in Imbaba, a poor neighborhood in Cairo. I went to another one outside of about an hour outside of the coastal city of Alexandria, where Christian homes were and businesses were burned. And in the reconciliation afterwards, several Christian families were ejected from the village. Christians protested in Cairo against yet another burning in Upper Egypt near Aswan. They decided to protest. They marched to the radio and television building, which is known as Maspero. From there, the military attacked them, running many of them over, while state television was calling on honorable Egyptians to come down and protect the army that was being attacked by Christians. Well, you could see on certain screens APCs running over Christians. 27 Christians were killed, and there's still been no justice for the victims. Last April, following another bout of violence, a funeral outside St. Mark's Cathedral, which is the seat of the Coptic Orthodox Pope, was attacked. The police, you could see the police working with locals attacking, and you could see tear gas going into the cathedral grounds. So it's not surprising that, throughout this time, 2013, people were becoming more and more angry at the rule of Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. So there was a group of five activists, and they started a campaign, and they called it Rebellion. And they gathered millions of petitions signed by people and designated June 30th as a day when they would come out and call for Morsi's ouster. And it was clear beforehand that many people were going to come out, many Muslims, and it was clear that Christians would join them. And they did, and I watched. It was amazing. I've seen a lot of large protests in Cairo because no one can quite do it like Egyptians can. And millions did come out. It was quite incredible. And after General Sisi ousted Morsi on July 3rd, because he said that he did not listen to the will of the people, it was both the Sheikh of Al-Azhar, Ahmed Taib, and the Coptic Pope, Tawadros, as well as Mohamed Berdeh and other political activists who stood with him. At the same time, you had Islamists increasing their numbers at the two sit-ins in Cairo. And their leaders were blaming, as they have before, even before this, they would often inciting rhetoric against Christians, blaming their political problems on the Christians. And once these sit-ins started, they had nightly people speaking at the podiums, and they would often be talking about Christians. And even their rank and file refused to believe that Muslims would actually protest against Morsi, that it must have been Christians and maybe, some old regime. But, no Muslims would do that, which was, crazy. And you could see it in the graffiti at one of the statues in Giza. There's a statue outside one of their protests, and they had put thugs plus Christians equals rebellion for the rebellion campaign. And then it would say Egypt is Islamic. And you'd see quite a bit of this all over, and you'd hear it in their chants. Egypt is Islamic. Egypt is Islamic. It's not... it wasn't quite as much about democracy as they had said. So I just wanted to give you a little background about what had happened and I had seen since the January 2011. And now I'm just going to go into the, I think sometimes people can miss what, when they come parachute into a place and they don't know the background and it's, they sort of cover it within a vacuum instead of going into what has been happening on the ground. But now I'm just going to go into the day of August 14th, and it was probably one of the craziest days I've seen in my 15 years of living in Egypt. And as they cleared the two sites, there were protests around. Some of the people who couldn't get into where the two sit-ins were being cleared, they would move around to other areas. So as you moved around Cairo, there was tear gas. They started things on fire. People set up neighborhood committees holding makeshift swords and metal poles, and streets were ripped apart. So there's stones that they would throw, and there was intercommunal violence between those who did not like the Brotherhood and the Islamists. And there was, you know, tear gas in the air. There'd be gunfire over here. Checkpoints, military checkpoints. It was a very chaotic day. And it was only in the evening as news, you could really figure out, news started to filter in that police stations, government buildings, and these churches were attacked. And but then the country was under a curfew, dusk to dawn. And you had to work on trying to figure out where are the churches, because you'd see pictures on Twitter like, it's here in Minya. Well, where in Minya? I found out the nearest one was in Kerdasa, which is in Giza, and it's near the Giza pyramids. And my driver had a friend who lived there who told me I shouldn't go there because a police station had been attacked and 15 policemen were killed. There was a big fight there. You could see video of a man with a rocket-propelled grenade. They mutilated the bodies of the policemen. And he also said that leading members of the Jamaat Islamiyah also lived there. The Jamaat Islamiyah is a terrorist group that fought an insurgency in the 1990s against the government. They've since renounced violence, but not their ultra-conservative ideology. And I think that's all been put into, we're not quite sure about that right now. I also called people in Coptic orphans to find out what was going on in other places like Minya, because they have orphanages were attacked as well around the country. And she told me the roads are not secure because sometimes the roads were being cut because the Islamists were having protests. And they also said that their communities were under lockdowns because of the violence that was happening. Each night I'm calling a human rights expert who works on religious freedom to get like a tally of as much as I could on areas where it was happening until you could actually get to a place to cover it from there. And you know, you'd get like how many churches were you know, businesses, orphanage, schools, how many dead, people kidnapped. Until finally I made it to Al-Nazla outside of Fayoum, and just this small village had the two churches and the monastery, and people there were so nervous, you know, they didn't want to go into the store to buy things that they needed, but they vividly described the repeated attacks that lasted all day. And like in other areas, the police was attacked and told, and they just ran away. But I think, you know, you could see that on the churches they cursed Christians on the walls of the burned churches. And then they wrote, "The religion of Allah is Islam," also on another part of the burned church. And often some of these places are small villages, and getting to them can be difficult. People give you directions and they go like this, and it's not on Google Maps, you know, and you're trying to find out where it is, and we had to be back by 7 p.m. before the military curfew took place. But I wanted to, there was a Bible association that I went into in Fayoum as well, We couldn't get into there. It was locked, but it had been burned and looted. But on the walls, it said the Islamists had written down with Tawadros after the Pope, the Coptic Pope. But the Christians, the local Christians there, had put something else on it, on the side of the gate. They said, love your enemies. And I thought that was very interesting that they had put on their own. And they also said in this village that, you know, they would rebuild. They said buildings can be rebuilt, but souls can't. So that's what I experienced.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Betsy Heil. I'd now like to pass over to Nina Shea. She is currently a senior fellow and director of the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute, and I think I can easily say that one of the world's foremost experts on freedom of religion and freedom in general. Nina Shea.
Thank you so much. I really want to thank everyone for coming tonight, and I especially want to thank Jenny Taylor and Lapidum Media for putting this on and for Douglas, Mary, and the Henry Jackson Society. It's a great honor for me to be on this panel with His Grace Angelos and our other distinguished panelists. I was asked to give the Washington perspective as a religious freedom advocate on the anemic coverage by our leading national press regarding the August attacks against the Copts and the churches. And I want to mention that my comments tonight do not apply to Betsy Heil. I've known Betsy for about 7 years, and I can say that without reservation that she is a very conscientious and incredibly courageous journalist.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I want to point out also that the relationship between the U.S. administration and our national press is like a double helix, that the issues, which issues receive attention and how they are shaped, are passed back and forth between the two. So it's very important how the press treats religion. In the middle of last year, after the Islamists swept multiple elections, news agencies in the United States began asking, how will this change Egypt? Newspapers like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal concluded with warnings. Alcohol could be banned, and women could be prohibited from wearing skimpy clothes at beach resorts. The UK Daily Mail had the unforgettable headline that sort of captured the spirit of all the press at that time, and that a headline that screamed, end of Sharm el-Sheikh. as appreciated as booze and bikinis are by the International Press Corps, this was utterly trivial compared to how the far-reaching and pressing aims of the Morsi government concerned tens of millions of Egyptians. A quickly drafted constitution that laid out the mechanisms for a Sharia state, the declaration that Morsi himself was above the courts, the rigorous prosecution of Islamic apostasy and blasphemy codes, the attacks on the churches, the overall lenient treatment of Islamists over the past year, particularly in the Sinai, in Luxor, and elsewhere, and above all, how Morsi neglected the economy to focus on these other issues. From the start at the Arab Spring, we were told by the American media that we were irrational to fear an Islamist order, that Egypt's was a liberal revolution. What could go wrong? That the Muslim Brotherhood did not seek the presidency, we were told that. When it became clear that it, in fact, did and had won overwhelmingly, the press shifted gears and repeatedly assessed the Muslim Brotherhood to be inclusive, moderate, patient, and pragmatic. Bringing in the double helix, in February 2011, U.S. Intelligence Director James Clapper testified in Congress that the Muslim Brotherhood was a largely secular and heterogeneous organization. He later modified this under intense criticism. The White House assured us that the revolution was on the right track. So how come so many got it so wrong? The national media, quite simply, are blind to religion. Little investigative journalism took place when it came to Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. As Egypt's largest and original Islamist organization, and according to its own claims, the only representation of political Islam in existence, the Brotherhood should have been put to the critical analysis the media applies routinely to other important organizations. American media also know very little about the Copts or their importance to Egypt. The negligent reporting by America's top national presses of the mid-August assault on Egypt's churches, and by the way, the largest single persecution since the 14th century against them, needs to be understood against this backdrop. I examined a sampling of America's leading national papers for this event. Most did a single report on the church attacks. That these single reports appeared in the context of daily reporting over a week on the Egyptian forces' bloody crackdown on Muslim Brotherhood protesters, which entailed horrific levels of violence and deserved all the attention it got. But there was another important human rights story that week. It was the Islamist attacks against the Copts, and this was all but missed by the American national media. That second story concerned the worst episode of persecution in 700 years against one of the oldest and largest remaining Christian communities in the Middle East. The reports were mostly belated and failed in probing basic questions such as who was responsible for the attacks, why were the Christians singled out to be the only civilian targets, and what was the purpose of these attacks? What was their significance and likely effect? Let's start with the Wall Street Journal, which publishes a piece on August 16th and was the most timely, if superficial, of the three. It focuses only on the single church attack in the one town, Kardasa. It relied only on government sources to assert, quote, the Brotherhood supporters have set ablaze three churches across Egypt. The article does not explore why the Christians were targeted or who led the attacks in Kardasa. The article is juxtaposed with a photo of a Cairo mosque that had been damaged by security forces during a raid of the Muslim Brotherhood sit-in. To its credit, the journal revisited the issue and allowed a fuller version of events to be told on August 21st when it asked the researcher, my colleague, research fellow, Hudson Center for Religious Freedom, Sam Tadros. They asked him to write an op-ed piece, which he entitled A Coptic Monument to Survival Destroyed. But this was not by the paper's regular reporter, and moreover, it did not appear in the regular op-ed pages, but appeared in Arts and Entertainment. In it, Sam described the scope of the attacks, their historical significance. He focused on the 4th century monastery of the Virgin Mary, 4th century, that had withstood the ages but was destroyed on August 14th and then designated as a space for Muslim prayers. This ancient monastery was proposed for designation as a UNESCO heritage site, served a living worship community, and was 200 years older than the Banyan Buddha statues that were destroyed by the Taliban. But unlike the Banyan, its destruction was mostly ignored by the rest of the mainstream press. Sam also addressed a very critical point, and that was the likely effect of these attacks on the forced immigration, driving out the Copts from Egypt. And we believe this was the a main purpose, not the only purpose, but a main purpose of the attacks, to terrorize the Copts into leaving. The Washington Post piece was printed on August 21st, a full week after the attacks started. Carried on page one, it gives a description of some of the attacks and a brief sketch of the attacks nationwide. The reporter raises the question of why the Copts, but does not question the logic of the answer. it quotes Egyptians saying that the attacks were in reprisal for the Pope supporting General Sisi. This is Pope Tewodros. Supporting General Sisi in the ouster of President Morsi. The journalist seems to accept this, failing to report the fact that other national figures like the Sheikh of Al-Azhar and a Nobel laureate also stood with Sisi, nor does this journalist make any attempt to explore why Christians were alone scapegoated. The article explores the authorship of the crime. She quotes an unnamed, high-ranking Western official making the astonishing and false assertion that, quote, we have seen zero indication that the Muslim Brotherhood is an organization in organizing these attacks. And by the way, a high-ranking Western official is usually, in the American press, someone from the American embassy. Well, what about incitement? The Muslim Brotherhood's, as many of us had been reporting, the Muslim Brotherhood's party webpage posted on August 14th lists a bill of particulars against the Christian Coptic minority, blaming it and only it for the military's crackdown against the Brotherhood, alleging that the church has declared, quote, a war against Islam and Muslims. It concluded with the threat, for every action there is a reaction. The article, the quote, the military republic of Coptic Pope Tewodros, carried on the Muslim Brotherhood website in July, and that sort of speaks for itself. And that was along the same vein. A researcher of Egypt's most respected human rights group, the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights, has asserted that the Muslim Brotherhood are, at quote, at least agitators in these incidents and at other times actually participate in the attacks against the Copts. Other human rights groups have said the same, including the independent congressionally established U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. I do not condone the killing of Muslim Brotherhood protesters that happened just before these attacks in any way. And I also acknowledge that others joined in, other Islamists and criminals joined in the attacks against churches and their looting along with Brotherhood supporters. But we got to keep in mind that there was incitement by the Muslim Brotherhood. This Washington Post reporter does not bother to look up the Muslim Brotherhood statements or the assessment of the human rights groups or dozens of testimonies of people recognizing church leaders, other leaders recognizing local Muslim Brotherhood leaders in the attacks. However, she does report later in the piece that seems to undercut this high-level Western official, a witness who offers this statement. Quote, one man said the group, this is her writing, quote, one man said the group, he saw attack a church had worn green headbands marked by the Muslim Brotherhood's insignia. Finally, moving on to the New York Times, it ran its piece also on August 21, a week after the attacks. It mentions attacks across the country and describes the events that took place in one town, Nasla, where Betsy also visited. It acknowledges that the Christians are being scapegoated, though he doesn't say why. This piece rightly lays heavy blame on the police for not protecting them, as do all the articles, by the way. It also is the only report of the three papers to clearly blame the Muslim Brotherhood for instigating the attacks, stating, quote, leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist party that propelled Mr. Morsi to power, encouraged or tolerated incitement against Christians at their sit-ins. It could have been a pretty good piece. It wasn't perfect, but it could have been a very good piece. It gave lots of details about the churches being attacked, the graffiti, and so forth. But the worst part about the Times reporting is that it knew of the attacks, the scope and the details, and the Muslim Brotherhood statements of incitement from day two. On August 16th, this was a week before it actually ran the piece in the paper, the New York Times had posted an excellent and informative piece on their relatively obscure blog called The Lead by Liam Stack. It would appear to me at least, that they made an editorial decision to withhold reporting the account of the attacks in the paper. And I know it's difficult and dangerous to go out of Cairo, but I have to wonder if they withheld it because it complicated the narrative of the Times' principal reporter in Cairo, David Kirkpatrick, that the Muslim Brotherhood was the victim, not the aggressor, and that it is moderate. There's also a detectable bias against the cops and no apparent appreciation for their status in the reporting of the paper's piece. For their status as the largest non-Muslim religious minority remaining in all of the Middle East, more than even the Jews in Israel, nor for their contribution within Egypt as a critical force for modernization and moderation in the country. After all, it was a Coptic Pope who established the first modern school and the first school for girls in Egypt, predating even the American University of Cairo about 100 years in its admission of girls. Also, diversity is extremely important. It gives us the experience of living together, something that the Egyptians have had for a very long time. Regarding the reaction of the U.S. government, this will be a very short discussion, since there's not much to tell. In his speech on events in Egypt on August 15th, President Obama devoted a fragment of a sentence to condemn the attacks against the churches. This is why they were still going on, day two of the attacks. At the State Department, Secretary Kerry has had nothing to say. The ambassador at large for religious freedom, and yes, we have one person in the State Department with an office and staff, its purpose monitoring these things, she has issued no statements whatsoever, not even a tweet. At the daily briefings, when asked about the church's attacks on August 14th, the State Department spokesperson expressed concern, adding without any sense of conviction or urgency, this is why the attacks are still going on, clearly, any reports of violence we're concerned about. And when it involves religious institutions, well, we're concerned about that as well, end of quote. On August 19th, she made a more emphatic condemnation, again, in response to a question. The administration was so silent that on September 12th, that's just last week, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which is an independent agency established by Congress, wrote to President Obama, urging him to, quote, speak out clearly and forcefully about the unprecedented sectarian attacks committed against Christians in Egypt. Went on to say, quote, we are deeply troubled that leaders and supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood tolerated or even encouraged incitement against Christians, and that the interim authorities stood by or were slow to react when attacks occurred. I found out yesterday after I arrived that Secretary of Defense Hagel has spoken privately to General Morsi to urge protection for the cops, but there's been no...
Cece, yes,
thank you. Thank you for listening to So I will end there. But obviously that I think that there's, again, a relationship that the press missed the story and so did the administration. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Nina Shea, for that rigorous and, I think for most journalists, sobering analysis. Daily Mail is a fine paper which I write for occasionally, but I think for it to have been the perfect Daily Mail storm, it would have had to have been the end of Sharm el-Sheikh and how it may affect the price of your house. But in any case, I'd now like to pass over to our fourth and final panelist, Tom Holland. He'll be well known to many of you. He's a best-selling, award-winning, and quite disgustingly prodigious historian. His superb recent book, In the Shadow of the Sword, many of you will have read, and he's also just today brought out his translation of Herodotus.
Next week.
They're all just round the corner from here as well. So in any case, without further ado, I'd like to pass over to Tom Holland, who also, I think, will talk not only about Egypt, but a bit wider across a region he knows well. Thank you.
Thank you, Douglas. And I'd like to add my thanks to the organisers of this event. And I guess that the self-appointed mission of Lapidot Media could be summed up as telling news organisations that it's more complicated than you think, which, of course, news organisations aren't tremendously keen on hearing. But I think that the three speakers we've already heard suggest how important it is. And as Douglas mentioned, I churn books out. And to be frank, I very rarely come unless I can promote a book. So I thought I'd kick off by looking at Herodotus. not just because I'm a shameless self-publicist, although that's obviously part of the equation, but also because I think in many ways he is the granddaddy of what we're talking about today. He is, in a sense, the very first foreign correspondent to visit Egypt. And he devotes an enormous amount of his histories to this extraordinary country. And he fixes on three interesting points that I think have sort of salience for what we're talking about today. First of all, he is very clear that Egypt is very odd from his perspective as a non-Egyptian. In almost all their customs and practices, he tells his audience, they do the exact opposite of the rest of mankind. So he's nailed that. Then he adds, they're very, very religious. Religious to an extreme, he says. And then finally, and this is the key point, the one that he never forgets, that haunts him throughout his account of Egyptian practices and history, their civilization is staggeringly old. In comparison to that of the Greeks are nothing but children. And I think that all three of those points are points that Western correspondents now, by and large, have to keep in their minds as well. And of course, if you are a Western correspondent and you go to Egypt, I think it's bound to seem a bit strange. It's clearly not part of, it's not part of the West. It is clearly very religious. But I think, oddly, certainly in light of what's been going on over the past 2-3 years, the fact that Egypt is clearly even older than it was in Herodotus' day tends to be slightly forgotten. And the focus, obviously, when the Arab Spring kicked off, there was a tremendous sense of excitement that, that what we might be getting might be the kind of liberal secular democracy with which I think Western news consumers and possibly journalists too, I don't know, tend to think is sort of paradigmatically modern. And so there was very much a focus in the early days of the Arab Spring in Cairo on attractive English-speaking liberal Egyptians who had Twitter accounts. And there was a general presumption that what Egypt was moving towards, ideally, was a kind of Western-style liberal democracy, and that was what modernism was all about. And, but in that sense, the struggle for democracy, the focus lay on the sort of the immaturity of Egyptian institutions. Egypt compared, say, to Britain or America, was a young country, which is, of course, absolute nonsense. Egypt is the oldest state in the world, and even now it remains one of the few, I guess Iran would be one, China perhaps might be another, in which the roots of the modern state recognisably lie in antiquity. And I think that it's not just religious literacy we need, it's historical literacy as well. And so in that light, I thought that I present you with three vignettes, three periods, long predating the emergence of England, let alone Britain, that I think shed light on Egypt today. And the first takes us way back to the Pharaonic period. And the Pharaonic state, as it emerged 3,000 BC, 5,000 years ago, really rested on three pillars. There was an autocracy, represented by the pharaoh, the god-king. There was a priesthood, clerisy, scribal, elite, and there was the army. And by and large, for most of pharaonic history, this worked very well. And really, it's when it breaks down that you become most interestingly aware of it. And the period where it most interestingly breaks down is in the 18th dynasty, the reign of the famous heretic pharaoh Akhenaten, who introduced a radical form of proto-monotheism. And could well have got away with it. He reigned for 18 years, and there were lots of people who signed up to his new religion, which required him to close down all the temples of the old gods and institute the worship of a new god, the Aten. But what happened ultimately was that this revolution got overwhelmed by famine and particularly by plague, and the Egyptians took for granted that this was an expression of the anger of the gods. And there is a sense throughout Egyptian history in which if natural disasters afflict Egypt, it is presumed that the heavens have been angered. And if the Egyptian people are fed, if they have plenty of bread to eat, then the heavens are pleased with Egypt. And in that light, I think that it's important to emphasize that the background to this is not just religious, it is also economic in Egypt now. It is extraordinary that a country that was known to the Romans as the breadbasket of the Mediterranean is now the largest importer of wheat in the world. And there was an extraordinary interview with President Morsi when he went to Alexandria, and he said, he was talking about his ambition to restore fertility to Egypt. He said, by God's will, in 2 years, we will be achieving more than 80% of our needs for wheat imports. And seek in 4 years not to import wheat at all. But unfortunately, God didn't will it. God was not on Morsi's side. And so, just as Akhenaten fell all those years ago, Morsi has fallen as well. And I think there is a clear continuity there. We move on. 2,000 years, because this is the wonder of Egyptian history. You can sort of dispatch 2,000 years, because we sweep the hand. And we move on to the 5th Christian century. Egypt has long since come under foreign rule. The age of pharaohs is gone. The Greeks, who founded the great city of Alexandria on the Mediterranean coast, have been displaced by the Romans. And a pagan world by this point is becoming Christian, hasn't yet fully become Christian. And in 412, a figure whom I'm sure the bishop will be more than familiar, becomes patriarch of Alexandria, a man called Cyril. And the background to Cyril's elevation to the patriarchate of Alexandria may well strike a few bells with those who are not familiar with it. The church in the pre-Constantinian period in Egypt had established itself in the face of repeated bouts of persecution by the Roman authorities. In part, at least, because it was a welfare state within the fabric of the Roman province. It provided welfare to people who otherwise would get nothing, to the poor, to the sick, to the young, and to the old. And this was a crucial part of its appeal. And it's a part of what the Roman authorities, when the Roman state converted to Christianity, then co-opted. It was, if you like, a kind of Christian brotherhood. But it also had, particularly under Cyril, it was not just devoted to works of charity. There were what I guess could only be described as bands of heavies, men called parabolani, who had originally been recruited as charitable workers, but who increasingly were deployed by Cyril in a paramilitary way against people that Cyril saw as enemies of the church. They were, for instance, people who had, as Cyril saw it, a heretical take on doctrine. They were Jews, and they were, of course, the surviving pagans. And so tumultuous did Cyril's attempts to seize control of the commanding heights of Egypt become that he got drawn into open conflict with the Roman secular authorities, represented by a man called Orestes, who was the prefect of Egypt. And it culminated in bloodshed. Orestes got hit. Someone pelted him with stones. He would have been lynched had passers-by not rescued him. And so you have this sense, again, of a tension between an organisation, the church, that sees itself as defined by God and superior to secular authorities, and a secular regime that wants to place limits on that. And what happens ultimately is that Orestes vanishes from the historical record. We don't know what happened to him. Cyril stays as patriarch for 32 years. And the impact of this period, it takes on a mythic quality that continues to resonate to this day. Cyril is a doctor of the church. he is a saint, he is a totemic figure, not just for the Copts, but for a lot of Christians everywhere. Likewise, one of the victims of the rioting that marked his patriarchate was Hypatia, who, insofar as secularists have a martyr, she is one of the crowning martyrs. And so again, there is a sense in which what happened long ago continues to reverberate into the present, not just in Egypt, but broader as well. My third vignette, we move forward again to a new imperial takeover, and we're looking at a man called Ibn Hassan, who has come from the Yemen, his family come from Yemen via Iraq to Egypt, and that reflects a new broad world. Egypt is now part of a new empire, and it's an Arab empire, and it's an empire, of course, that is Muslim. And Ibn Hassan is writing a biography of the man who, in the opinion of Muslims, provides the model of how a state should be run. He's the first biographer of Muhammad whose account of Muhammad we have complete. And this again is something new. There is a sense, of course, in which Islam is drawing on what had gone before, is drawing on the example of the Coptic, the Christian dynamic in Egypt, and of course the imperial systems that had preceded Christianity. But what is new, I think, is this idea that God has prescribed a particular way in which he wants people to behave on the individual level. Set it all out, just in the Quran, but in sayings of the Prophet that have been compiled in great volumes. But he's also set out the parameters for how a state itself should be organised. And of course, one of the issues that faces the nascent Muslim state is how to deal with those who are not Muslim. Muhammad's attitude towards pagans is as stern as Cyril's. He doesn't approve of them at all. Get rid of them. His attitude towards the Jews and the Christians, more nuanced. They are described as people of the book, and they are offered protection. But in return, they have to pay tax, the jizya. They are classified as dhimmis, and the bishop said that there has been interfaith dialogue for 1400 years in Egypt. That is, of course, true, but for much of that, in fact, for all of it, except for, I suppose, during the British-French period, the interfaith dialogue was taking place with a period of a state of disequilibrium between the Christians, who were classified as inferior, and the Muslims, of course, who were the rulers. And this has an obvious resonance and impact again into the present, because the issue of how you square the fact that for many Muslims in Egypt, Muhammad's primal state in Medina offers a model for how Egypt should be run, and the prescriptions that he supposedly set out for how Jews and particularly Christians should relate to the Muslim state is taken absolutely seriously. Against that is the problem that these derived from a period very, very long ago. And so the challenge of squaring that is something that I think is sort of grinding away beneath the surface. And it's something almost that even the Muslim Brotherhood, maybe even the Salafists in Egypt, are reluctant to face up to, because the awkwardness of squaring that, I think, is something that confronts Muslims as much as Christians. So I think that the part of the fascination of Egypt is precisely the fact that it is not a young country, it is sensationally old, and its antiquity continues to impact on what is going on now, right now. When President Sadat got killed, his assassin cried out, "I killed Pharaoh." One of the reasons why Mubarak fell, one of the reasons why the army withdrew its support, was the anxiety that he wanted to establish a kind of pharaonic regime, that he wanted his son to succeed. It's one of the reasons why the rug was pulled out from under his feet. And what we see now in the recent protests are protesters holding up placards showing Morsi as a pharaoh. The bishop said in his speech that all the people who gathered on the streets protesting against Mubarak, they all wanted a new start. But I suspect that in Egypt, of all countries, getting a new start is very, very difficult.
Well, thank you very much, Tom Holland. I'm now going to open this out to the floor. We've got just under 30 minutes, I see we've got an extraordinarily well-informed audience, as we've already seen. And I just wanted to ask, I'll try to take questions in groups of three, if possible. And I'll start on the front here, if somebody wants to get a microphone here. And I just wanted to ask really three very quick housekeeping things for Q&A. Firstly, please do introduce yourself if you think it's relevant. Secondly, do please keep your questions short. And thirdly, please make sure there's a question mark at the end of it. And without any further ado, the gentleman here at the front.
Thank you very much. My name is Hassan Imam, an Egyptian journalist living in the United Kingdom. I add my voice to that of Nina regarding my sense of dismay about how the West, and in my case, how the British reacted to events in Egypt after the so-called coup. On the government level, we found that there was a shy reaction, which is tinged with support for the Muslim Brotherhood, and this is actually related to the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood had for many years here PR company working for them and promoting their interests, and the British from the very beginning of what happened thought that Egypt is going to follow the Turkish model of Mr. Erdogan, and this is the sound policy that should be followed. And in the statement issued by the British government, I took exception to one issued by the Foreign Secretary at the beginning of what happened, and wrote back to him to say, you are not naming names, you are ignoring the fact, you are equating the state with one group of people who failed miserably and brought Egypt into a failed state, and you didn't mention their name or what they are doing and terrorizing the churches, all that. So this is on the one side. The media issue is more of a great concern, because actually the British media was worse than the American media. They didn't mention the attacks on the churches for so long until a piece in the Financial Times came out, in a way naming names and issuing a sort of stark warning about what's happening, followed by the Guardian and the Times. But the main concern was whether this is a coup or not a coup, a semantic way of looking at things in a very way of sophistry without trying to understand and comprehend what is going on. My question is, what is the way forward what we are witnessing now in Egypt from a British perspective?
Excellent.
Have there been a change in tone since things became clearer or not?
Excellent. Thank you very much. The superb question. Didn't strictly follow my rules, but a very important one nonetheless. I hope the next ones will, and I'll very quickly take the gentleman in the second row there, if I may, yes, and then quickly we'll go to the gentleman over there. Thank you.
Part of the a lot of English people, the Muslim Brotherhood has been going since 1940 or 60, and they've made their agenda quite plain, and we know that the Egyptian people didn't have much choice. Why did they choose it?
Very good question. And the gentleman there in the third row.
John Fenner. Can anyone on the panel, plot the outcome, please? Will the military actually revert to democratic elections? If so, who is going to create mature political parties apart from the Muslim government?
Right. Shall I, Nina, would you like to answer the first question? Then I shall ask perhaps everyone to predict the future.
Okay, yeah, you make a lot of very good points. I really don't know Great Britain, the UK, I don't know what they will do. But there are lots of opportunities for them to start doing the right thing, just as is for the United States. We have a constitution drafting process going on right now. That's very important how that turns out. The Morsi one erected the architecture for a Sharia state and very much curtailed religious freedom and was pretty specific about how Sharia should be defined. We're going to have, there's a myth that Islamism is dead in Egypt because the Muslim Brotherhood has been dealt a very hard blow. That's for sure. But it's not dead because of two things. One is that there are many Salafi parties, and they're still part of this process, and they will be voting, and they will be having influence on the constitution, and also because the culture is heavily Islamic. This was a country where the Pew organization did a poll last year and found out that 75% of the population was in favor of stoning for adultery and wanted to see apostates put to death. So this is a very Islamist culture. Islamism is not dead there. So I'll just leave you with those thoughts.
Perhaps to answer the second and perhaps a part of the third question, perhaps Betsy Howe first.
You had asked about why they voted for him. I watched the whole, since the revolution and through the successive elections, and there was no doubt that the Muslim Brotherhood, as an organization that started in the 20s, had a lot of organizational skills on the ground. But also when it came, because of the corrupt regime under Mubarak, a lot of people, when they were looking to vote, especially in the initial parliament votes, you could ask people, who do you want to vote for? And they're like, I don't know, I want a God-fearing man. And what they meant by it was somebody who would be honest. And he was seen that if he was God-fearing, that he was a good man, and that he wouldn't be so corrupt and steal their money from them. And so that was part of it, and part of the thing that, and the way that the political process was pushed forward, it came down to someone from the old regime who was in, and Mohamed Morsi. And as people described it to me, they compared it between cholera and plague. And they really, I felt, when I heard those two, the runoff were going to be between those two, people were just, and they talked about squeezing a lemon on their head because of the bitterness of trying to have to vote for either one of those people. And some people didn't vote, and some decided, a lot of revolutionaries decided to give Morsi a chance, and many who did were the ones who came back on June 30th and turned him out again.
Bishop Angelos, I wonder if you could pick up on some of that question and also of the gentleman's question, the third question on what's to come.
I don't want to repeat a lot of what Betsy's already said because I think I agree with all of it. First of all, there was a great political, I think, inability to choose. There wasn't enough development or literacy, political literacy. People were there as illiterate and poor, and sometimes both, who were going to, as far as they were concerned, vote for the symbol of the watch and the symbol of the cow and the symbol of the umbrella. That's what they were told to do. So there wasn't the informed solution. Secondly, a lot of people did vote anti-Shafi rather than pro-Morsi. And that was because they would rather have the Muslim Brotherhood that presented an ideological solution, because their catch cry for 70 years was Islam huwa al-hal, Islam is the solution. And so people wanted to believe that. And they wanted to go for the underdog, because they had believed that the Mubarak regime actually had pressed down the Brotherhood and kept it underground, therefore it might have a way. There wasn't much of an alternative. And I think a lot of people abstained completely. A lot of people, as Betsy said, also who voted came back and apologized on social media saying, we're sorry we ever gave you our votes. So that was, I think that was very clear. There was a vote of no confidence at the end of the day. People recognized that there was a vote, And if you go back to the days of the election, there were lots of accusations of rigging, of strong-arm tactics, of abuse of power, of the use of financial resources to help people. And even with all of that, there was a 0.7% majority that got Morsi through, even with all of that. On to whether there is going to be a move ahead, and it's very important for me to clarify that we don't follow media rhetoric, and the fact that I, as a representative of the church, say that we think the army did an honourable thing. We're not just pro-army or anti-Morsi, because we are the same people who suffered during Maspero when the army ran over our own faithful. So we're not blindly following anyone. We are looking at points along a continuum of history. I think it's clear to say that the way the military did this was it never actually assumed authority of the country for a day, because Morsi was ousted one day, 12 hours later, the interim president was voted in. So the General Sisi actually never assumed power. Is the army going to hand over? It looks like that. There is an interim government, there is an interim cabinet, there is a process towards a constitution that is now more inclusive and doesn't just focus on the Islamist parties after everyone had walked out the first time. And there is every indication that this roadmap that has been drawn towards handing over power through a democratic election is being followed. Now, time will tell, and the days will test this theory. I personally think that there will be a democratic process towards a proper election. Whether that is possible or not, within, again, a time, a frame, where you educate people politically and give them plausible options, is something else to be looked at.
Thank you very much. Jenny Taylor wants to say a very quick word about the British media before I go to Tom Holland and then back out to you, the audience.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to pick up the question about, or the statement about the paucity of coverage by the British press. It's why this event is happening. The British press unfortunately seem to believe that you must report religion as if it were a sort of Westminster debate, mm-hmm. with on the left wing you have the underdogs and on the right wing you have the overdogs, and Christians, because they are Western, are somehow colluding with the overdogs. We've got to stop this. We really have got to recover a sense of a false story, because even I have been stunned at the evidence that Nina's given us, and I follow this, you know. So I'm preaching to myself. We've got to do better than we do. We've got to get rid of our ridiculous binary blinders, if you like.
Thank you very much, Jenny. And quickly to
sorry,
Tom. Whilst the microphone is there, yes.
Following from that. First of all, the concept of colluding, I completely agree with you, is a misunderstanding, because Christians have always been accused of going to the West for support, whereas actually it never happened. And when Pope Theodosius was asked about the churches that were burnt, he said, well, this is a sacrifice we presented for Egypt moving on. It is, however, important to see that at Rabaa al-Adawiyya, with the protests, as soon as there was a move against the Brotherhood, they called upon the West to come in, and they called for boots on the ground in Egypt. And that was very important to show that wasn't flagged up at all.
Thank you very much. Very quickly, and then the microphones will be at the back there. Thank you.
The issue of what's going to happen, the brilliant thing about being a historian is that you concentrate on what has happened rather than what will happen. But I think that one thing that is, it's pretty safe to say, is that there's going to be an awful lot of debate. There is no clear path ahead for Egypt, I would say. And I think that essentially there is an issue, and it's a religious issue that lies at the heart that Egypt is somehow going to have to solve, and it's sort of framed by a couple of details in the old constitution. One article said that there is absolute equality between citizens, and the other one states that Islam is the religion of the state. And there is clearly a tension there.
Sunni Islam.
Yes, Sunni Islam. Yes. And there is clearly a tension. I mean, it's perfectly possible. You know, Britain has an established church, so you can sort of magic that away. But I think that either, you know, at one extreme, there is going to be people who are arguing for Western-style Western secularism. And then at the other extreme, you have... you know, Jama'a is the Mayor, which in the 90s were trying to extract the jizya from Copts. Mm. So those are pretty hefty poles to negotiate, and I think it's going to be a mess for a long time.
Thank you very much, Tom. There's a gentleman exactly opposite me down the aisle at the very back, if the microphone could go to him first, and then a gentleman I saw over there, and I'm afraid the microphone is at the back at the moment, so yes.
It's a bit of an elephant in the room type of question.
Have you got the microphone, sir? Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. The most obvious question is, why was world Christendom silent when all this happened? And second question, where were the enlightened Arab Twitterati? You know, where were they?
Two very good questions. The gentleman there, also at the back, who's I think just there, and then I'd like somebody from this side at the back.
My name is Ibrahim Khalid. I'm an Egyptian Coptic and activist. And my question is, why did the USA do not share a single moral value with the Muslim Brotherhood? Can you explain, or can Nina Sheikh explain?
Sorry, could you slightly, could you just repeat that last bit? It wasn't entirely clear. Speak up a little.
While the USA and Muslim Brotherhood do not share a single moral value.
Oh. Right.
Can
thank
somebody
you.
Explain why Barack Obama
don't share a single moral
position?
Mm.
In supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, as we can see,
thank you.
It's very reluctant to blame the Muslim Brotherhood. And why is the media silent? Is it because of the $1 billion? They own, say, maybe 30% of the Guardian?
It is a very good question. And the other side, perhaps, we haven't heard from a woman yet, by the way, in the audience. And very conscious that we should at some point. Is there? I will even go to the front of the room if we have a woman. Okay, go on. Yes.
Good evening, I'm Samuel Lamy, and student of Middle Eastern history. And we've had several references already to the early 20th century where the Muslim Brotherhood was formed, and more recent when Anas Sadat was murdered. My question is, why is no one then talking about the secular liberal democratic experiments of the early 20th century with the Bloc Party and Salah Saglou and Malcolm Obey, and what lessons could be learned about the intelligentsia and the innate progressive thinkers in Egypt?
That's another very good question. Thank you. Perhaps I give him a Nina Shea first.
Okay, I'm going to address why the Obama administration supported the Muslim Brotherhood when they don't share a single value. I mean, it's a difficult question, involves a lot of judgment calls, but I would say just off the top of my head that the administration and prior administrations have reflexively supported democracy building, but it's been sort of a thin democracy, a democracy that is about process, about getting out to the vote. How do you get voter turnout? And not about values. The other part of this explanation is that very little is known about the Muslim Brotherhood. So whatever Obama and Hillary Clinton and others, who Kerry, think about the Muslim Brotherhood, I don't really know, but if they were just reading the press, it goes to what I was talking about this evening. They'd got very little information. If they had looked at Sam Tadros' work or Eric Traeger at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, they would have learned that the Muslim Brotherhood is a very tightly organized and disciplined organization, very cohesive. It takes up to 8 years to become a full-fledged Muslim brother worker. There are five stages during which applicants are monitored, indoctrinated, tested. They maybe take an oath of loyalty. This is not the kind of organization that's going to have a lot of flexibility internally, that is going to be extremely disciplined and cohesive. It's not going to be open to innovative ideas. They don't have, as it turned out, I think Betsy said something that was very full of insight, and that is that people in Egypt voted for them because they were sick of corruption and they wanted an honest, godly government. And basically, the Muslim Brotherhood's entire economic plan was no corruption. They said that they were working on an economic plan, but that plan was always kept secret. It turned out there was no plan. The end of corruption was their entire economic, they're sort of a pre-modern organization. And so, but all these, you know, this is not reported and this is not discussed and in Washington. And so if you're just reading the major national influential press, you will think that they are a modern political party, just like the Christian Democratic Parties of Europe, which is what we were told over and over again.
I wonder if Tom.
I mean, it's surely also for the same reason that they backed Mubarak, that they want stability in Egypt, and they hoped that the Muslim Brotherhood would provide it. And also, the Muslim Brotherhood had actually won the election, and the Americans are pledged to defending democracy. And so, if you have a democratically elected president for the first time in Egypt's history, what's the US to do?
I wonder also, whilst the microphone is with you, Tom, I wonder if you could perhaps address not only the gentleman's point about the last century, but also the very pertinent points of the first gentleman at the back.
Could you remind me what the very pertinent point is?
Could you? No. Among other things, what happened to the liberal sort of Twitterati, as it were, during this period? Where were the...
They're still there, and they're still very much part of the debate. And of course, yes, there are those traditions from the early 20th century to draw on. But it seems to me, as someone who's in no way an expert on this and just a consumer of the much berated British media, that they're in the shadow at the moment. And it may well reflect the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood, as you've been saying, is incredibly well organised. You're up against the wall.
And perhaps over to this side, perhaps Bishop Angelos, you could address whichever of those questions you'd most like to.
I'm thankful to the question in the back about where was the Christian voice. But it's not just the Christian voice. Where was the Muslim voice? Where was the voice that speaks for human rights at a general level? And I do a lot of ecumenical work in the United Kingdom, as well as interreligious work. And I did have some very honest words that came from a lot of pain to my sisters and brothers here on the ecumenical scene, and those who also are involved in Christian-Muslim relations, and said, if these were 50 mosques or synagogues or temples that were destroyed in 48 hours, how many of us would have been tripping over ourselves, trying to make statements and make apologies and take task forces out there and go and support, and yet none of that happened. And unfortunately for us, being British, it happened in August, and everything stops in August. But it would seem that terrorism didn't stop in August. This was a very real violation. Those of you who don't know, and I'm sure everyone on the panel knows, for Coptic Christians, the church is an extension of their own family and their own homes. So this wasn't just like burning down a church in the center of London. This was a very personal violation to Coptic Christians who lost their homes and lost the places that they were baptized in, they served in, and they were married in, and they spend most of their week in. So I was very disturbed, and what I'm hoping, and I've used this opportunity to actually make sure this doesn't happen again, putting in processes in the ecumenical instruments and in the interreligious instruments, saying, I don't want another person to feel this pain. I'm in the inner circle of all of this, and I was forgotten, and my church was forgotten, and my people here were forgotten. And it wasn't just affecting Coptic Christians in Egypt, it affected Coptic Christians here who had relatives in Egypt. And, you know, I think that will be addressed, and I'm hoping that's a very positive point that will come out of this.
Sure.
Yeah.
I can talk about on the ground. I do know that in places there were Muslims who were trying to help the Christians and in various places. And some were saved because Muslim neighbors came out. In the place where I was at Nuzla, the mob also tried to attack Christian homes as well, especially those who had led the campaign to oust Morsi in that village. And their Muslim neighbors came out and protected the homes but weren't able to protect the church. And so there was that, and there was outrage by those in the liberal side of things at what was going on. But unfortunately, you also find people who would use this opportunity, who maybe weren't with the Muslim Brotherhood, but hey, it's a chance we can also go loot, and you know, they'd see their fan that belonged in the church with their neighbor. Which has been a problem too. They get stirred up and then they go, oh yay, let's join the crowd, and it becomes bigger. And that is also a problem once these things start. So it goes both ways, and it also is part of education is needed, which is a process I think all the way across the board, I think, would help things.
Thank you very much. We've got time.
One point to follow that. The first is that there's a wonderful story in one village where Muslims came out to protect a church, and the Christians sent them away and said, don't worry, if it gets burnt down, we'll rebuild it. We just don't want to lose you. And that's what's happened in the life of this, bring people together. Secondly, I think it's important to realize that one of the statements I made is that this was definitely orchestrated. You can't have this many attacks in such a short period. And if it wasn't, it actually flags up a much more important and dangerous point of an underlying aggression that hasn't been dealt with for decades and needs to be dealt with.
Thank you very much. I've got time for a final round, really, of very brief questions. The microphone's with the gentleman there. If we could go to you, and then we'll have the lady here. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your insightful comments. My question, the phrase freedom of religion has been said many times in the room here tonight. How free are journalists in Egypt to report properly about these issues, not only female journalists, but also male, to travel freely around the schools?
Very important question. Thank you. The lady just here on the inside, yes. Thank you.
We have various organizations working with interface, community faiths together. Is there anything like that going on in Egypt or other areas of the country?
Thank you. And then I saw another hand somewhere at the back. As you know, whilst it's there, the lady here along the road, thank you. Who'd like to go first on that? Perhaps whilst the microphone is with you, Bishop. That's a very important question. Thank you. And it does bring us on to Syria. Perhaps people would like to, in making their comments, the final round, refer a little to that.
Very briefly, on the interfaith side, there has been quite a good and iconic relationship over decades, and in particular over the past decade and a bit, between Al-Azhar and the leadership of the Coptic Orthodox Church, between the Pope and the Grand Imam of Al-Azhar. That's always been very healthy, and we've seen the current Grand Imam actually being very astute in his decisions, although he was very much criticized by the Muslim Brotherhood because he wasn't going down the same line. There was a rejection of the Al-Azhar being a leading force in Egyptian Islam, and the Brotherhood was trying to take that position. There's also something started called Beit al-Aila, the family home, which was trying to bring Christians and Muslims together in the light of the first uprising in 2011 and carries on. Thirdly, there was a great initiative which was carried out last year, where a group of Christian priests and ministers from various denominations, as well as a group of imams, came together. We've seen this happen in England quite a lot, but it was the first time it actually happened in Egypt. And for some of the imams, it was the first time for them to sit with a Christian priest. And I think that exchange, I don't know how much to the heart of it went, but I think it's an important step. On Syria, the dynamics in Egypt are very different to Syria. Syria is a very, very diverse community in terms of religions and tribes and sects and gatherings. And so I think it's a very different dynamic. But I think what happened to the Brotherhood in Egypt is going to impact what happened in Syria, because the domino effect did not take off. And I think the success of the Brotherhood in Egypt, being the birthplace of the Brotherhood, was going to be very significant throughout the Middle East. And I dare say there's been a strategic weakening of that because of what's happened in Egypt.
Yes, I was going to address about the journalists' work in Egypt. At times, especially during this last couple of months, it became quite difficult at days to work. You always had to make sure if you're going to a place that you could get back by the time the curfew started, and especially when the curfew was at 7 p.m. You also had to make sure you knew updated on the roads because there were ongoing protests every single day, and they were cutting off roads, and there could also be altercations between the police and the military and the Islamists. And so you had to worry about that. And then you also had to worry about if there was no security at all, how secure it was going to be if there was, you know. So you always had to be aware of what was going on, where it was going on, what neighborhood it was happening in, because you had to know whether this was a predominantly anti-Brotherhood neighborhood or this was a pro-Brotherhood neighborhood. And so it's very like moving pieces, and you just have to be really aware to stay safe and cover things.
I'll do that. Thank you very much. Nina Shea.
Yeah, I'm going to just talk briefly about Syria, if that's okay. There is a sectarian war going on in Syria. It's within the Muslim community, with the Alawite government being backed by the Shiites of Iran, Hezbollah, and the rebel forces being backed, in addition by the United States, largely by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. The Christians are caught in the middle of this, but they're not fighting. But their churches were registered by the Alawite government, and so they are blamed for being aligned with them. So in addition to being caught in the middle, they have no militias of their own. They're also, what's going on in what I call a shadow war against the Christians, primarily by the rebels. And they are, there are jihadists, there's Al-Qaeda, there's various other groups who are attacking and killing Christians. And when they conquer an area, conquer a village or a town, they will set up Sharia courts and a Sharia state, many states. And the Christians who are left in these states, most are leaving or fleeing. The patriarch, it was the Catholic Melkite patriarch, said that half a million Christians have already left their homes. Not all of them have left the country, but they've been displaced. That's a quarter of the entire Christian population of Syria and in the last 2 years. When the Sharia courts are set up, the Christians are given a choice to convert to Islam or be killed or pay a tax. They can't afford the tax, because if they can afford it, the tax gets raised. So they have two choices, to be killed or to leave or to convert, three choices. And they're leaving. The other problem is when they leave, they do not want to go to the UN camps, because these are controlled internally by Sunnis, and they are recruited to go fight in Sunni militias at night, as are all the men in the camps. So we're focusing on trying to help them in two ways. One is trying to identify humanitarian agencies who can help the Christians now, because they're not in the UN programs, they're not in the refugee camps, they're in Lebanon or Turkey, outside the camps, living in villages, maybe churches, local churches and schools. Inside the country, there are you know, hundreds of thousands without help. The other thing is that recently in Washington it came to light that the rebels have the Free Syrian Army, the moderates, have produced something called the Damascus Plan, which has is a strategic plan for after the conflict ends, or for ending the conflict and for after it ends. And a component of this is, it was raised, was retribution killings. And it said in the rebel plan that there won't be any retribution killings because the rebels plan to put the regime on trial. Now, the Christians aren't really part of the regime, so there was nobody addressing the retribution killings, which have already underway in against Christians in Syria. So we're trying to wake up the West and the American government to take steps now to prevent and protect this very vulnerable population.
Thank you very much.
If we're looking at Egypt in the context of Syria and broader events in the Middle East, there's obviously only one place to start, and that is clearly the Achaemenid Empire of the 5th century BC. And the reason for that is that it established a model of rule over the Middle East that lasted for about 2,500 years. And essentially, that was that you had an imperial centre, a particularly privileged religion, a privileged imperial people, but everyone under the aegis of that imperial system were granted tolerance as long as they paid their taxes and did their duty, and in return they were allowed to basically to live and to do as they liked. And that was a system that essentially maybe evolved over time, but essentially it was the system that was still in place under Ottoman rule. And that changed in the 20th century, and what you saw was a whole grinding process by which the various minorities of the Levant in particular were expelled from their host countries. So you had Turks expelled from Greece going to Turkey, you had Greeks going to Greece. Israel is part of that phenomenon, the establishment of the Jewish homeland, and of course the expulsion of Greeks and Jews from Egypt is also part of that fabric. And I think that to be incredibly depressing, we can see that that process didn't end, that it's ongoing. And that what's happened in Iraq is the homogenization of Iraqi society. Christians were expelled from Iraq, essentially, went to Syria, they're now being expelled from Syria. I think that what we're watching, tragically, is the effective extinction of Christianity in its birthplace. Yeah. It may be that the Copts have enough weighted numbers to survive. It may be that the Jewish state will survive, but I fear that what we're witnessing is the sort of the climax of a process that was actually grinding its way through the 20th century, and it could be that we're witnessing something on the scale and horror and protracted impossibility of settling on the scale of the European 30-Year War. I mean, I hope that's not the case, but in my, you know, the more I read the newspapers, the more I read about Syria, the more I read about Iraq, the sheer scale of the hatreds, the sheer scale of the sectarian religious rivalries that are festering and growing all the worse, and you think back to what used to be there, it's very hard to feel optimistic. And on that cheery note, sorry.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Thank you, Tom. I'm constantly, we've ever so slightly overrun, but I just wanted to say a few thank yous. First of all, to say once again thank you to Jenny and Lapto Media. Thank you to my colleagues at Henry Jackson Society, in particular to Hannah Nom and my other colleagues there. I'd also like to thank you, the audience. I can think of very few events at which questions and insight from the audience has been so penetrating and so pertinent and informed. And thirdly, to thank the panel. The subtitle of this evening's event was Why the Truth is Getting Lost. I think you'll agree with me, it hasn't been lost in the National Liberal Club here tonight. And that's because of this very distinguished, superb panel. So please join me in showing your appreciation to them one more time. Thank you.